Look at the screen.
William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter. Yes, this is a podcast all about Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, Manhunter. It's Mindhunter because at One Hit Minute Productions, it's all things by minute. However, today's guest had just as much influence on the way that this show is being produced as really anything we've ever done in the series. He is the host of Increment Vice on this very network. He has been a legendary guest on One Heat Minute. In fact, was the one and only guest that had to like take over hosting of the show because I was almost inconsolable on one of the final episodes of One Heat Minute. He is truly the most talented, critical mind in print that you could ever hope for. And he also does a badass commentary track across places like Vinegar Syndrome and Imprint Films, which you guys would have heard us gush about many a time. For whatever reason, we find ourselves together in many ways. We find ourselves together on productions like Increment Vice. We find ourselves together in Imprint box sets. We find ourselves together on the same damn discs of Imprint sometimes. And truly, I wouldn't have it any other way. He's an editor at Brightwell Dark Room. He's truly a talent that is boundless, and I love him. He's one of my dearest friends. It is the legendary Travis Woods. Hello, buddy.
What a coronation, Blake, buddy. You're I say this every time. You're so good at that. Now that I've retired from my hyperbolic intros.
You did some great hyperbolic intros as a fan of hyperbolic intros.
I really got that sweet spot down of hyping. I like to hype a guest up. You know, you got to make him feel safe, make him feel
and
excited.
Comfy. Yeah.
You know, greetings from Blake Howard, the Lord Blake Howard, the warrior of the wasteland, the Ayatollah of rock and rolla, you know, shit like that. But you've taken my mantle. I think it just like a, you know, just like the letter, the fake letter from Hannibal Lecter to Dolarhyde, you know, you've taken my mantle, you've superseded me. But yes, I'm so glad to be back to talk about this wild ass film. Really, really wild man film. Really unique kind of. This is an outlier for him, and I know.
Yeah.
Normally we shoot the shit a lot about random things before an episode kicks off, but just gonna say, rewatching this, boy, this is a weird one. This is a weird one for our pal, for your pal, your buddy, your best friend, your bosom buddy, Michael Mann.
Every time I talk to Travis, he's like, "So your best friend, Michael Mann?" I'm like, "He's not my best friend, but I'm pretty grateful that he knows me. It's nice to know. It's nice to know your hero, and for him to be fucking cool as hell." It's pretty
cool.
He
doesn't just know you, Blake. In keeping with this film, he sees you.
He does. He really
and you see him. And that is something that is going to be very thematically is going to honeycomb over this episode. You like that?
I love everything. I love
thematically
everything.
Lattice itself like a weave. Across the... Oh, your poor listeners.
Oh
My poor
God.
listeners.
Not my
Yeah.
poor listeners. They're the best and you're the best. Oh God. Oh, I just want to touch your
That's it. That's
face.
all I got. That's
That's
it,
all we got.
everybody.
That's
Great
it.
episode. See you next
I've had a
time.
great time. I've had a great time.
Strong as I am.
Yeah.
Wow. Michael Mann, Manhunter. Just a
It's
weird one. Just a weird one for him.
weird to have it's weird to be so early in your career to have, I mean, Thief, it's so weird to say what a quintessential Michael Mann movie is, but like kind of all starts with Thief, and I think that the
He's
like
the
the
Big Bang. It contains all the star stuff that spreads throughout the rest of the filmography.
100%. And I think it's also the framing device by which you approach him and in a lot of ways. And so then you have these weird outliers. We were just talking off air about the Arrow release of the Keep on 4K.
Vinegar syndrome.
Oh,
Vinegar
Vinegar,
syndrome.
sorry, Vinegar Syndrome, not Arrow. Vinegar Syndrome. Of the maestros, how they made that happen, we'll never know. But that and this come in, and it's his. It actually does. You like Thief does have all that stardust, but like later on, you sort of see modern man and sort of post 2000s man swing back around to the kind of stylized view that he kind of creates here in Manhunter. Things sort of reground themselves and become more Thief adjacent, and the connections feel so strong all the way from Mohicans to the Insider and even Ali. And then this is the much more sort of abstract one here. And I know that you love this, but I'm just like, I just love this kind of man in God mode in 86. And it's just the style is, you know, for a person who I associate with style so heavily, you being your like literally your writing style is so you, and reading you is like you're in that person's brain. Manhunter is man like painting with his most florid style so early, so early.
Yeah, I mean it's the cinegrammer of this movie. It's just
Yes.
pure. I've said this before, or written it before. It's just pure Art Deco detective noir, and these broad strokes of like neon expressionism. And I got to write that down because I can't let someone else use that.
I'll send you the transcript of the episode
Thank
just so you've
you.
got
Copyright 2024.
that.
No, it's, I don't quite remember, every time I saw a Michael Mann movie for the first time. I remember seeing Heat the first time. My old man took me to see it over Christmas break in 95. I remember seeing Thief the first time. There's other ones that I'm just, they're just lodged in my memory as ever present. But I do remember watching this film for the first time, and I remember really disliking it. At that time I had this idea of Michael Mann, Thief and Last of the Mohicans and Heat especially. I think I by this point Collateral had already come out and I still had not seen this one. For whatever reason, I really don't know why. But I kind of imagined Michael Mann's films a lot the way Jamie Foxx describes Island Limo's cool groove experience, minimalist, terse, neon tracers going across the sleek hood of a car driving down a rain-stained street. What I didn't expect, are all these almost full-length pop music videos and the, like I said, the Art Deco and the strange surreality of the environments. It turned me off at first, and I was like, "What is this? The Keep Two?" And it kind of is, but in a good way. This film, it feels very visually overwhelming at first, as if man himself was overwhelmed by the 1980s. When I was younger, and I was teaching myself about music, and I was, burning through the discographies, and I swear to God, this is going somewhere. One Heat Minute listeners, no, I'm gonna get somewhere eventually.
He's
Just
getting there, guys. He's getting there.
let
Let
me
the
take a
train
walk. Let's just take a walk. Let's just take a walk.
Train speed
Yeah,
up. We're
let's
gonna
just
get
take a
there.
walk. But you listen to, there's that moment when you're in your teens and you're first getting into music, and or at least I did, and you're teaching yourself about, okay, I got to listen to everything by Neil Young. I got to listen to everything by Lou fucking Reed. I got to listen to everything by Bob Dylan. And it's all great. And then you get to their 80s albums and you're just like, what the hell happened? What happened? The decade and
And for Australians too, because particularly that English to Australia connection, it's the same with David Bowie. Like you're like you jump from the 70s Bowie into 80s Bowie and you're like, what the fuck is going on? Like, especially that time, because you're trying to, as you said, your self-education. I definitely did that. And when I heard the Bowie 80s albums, I was, some people described the CDs as coasters. They're like, you never put them back in the player.
Easy, Blake. Easy, easy. I like Let's Dance. Easy, easy.
No, I love them. Now as an adult, I love them. But it's just that it's hard. It's a shock.
It's you're definitely hearing your rock and punk godfathers find themselves, much like Tommy Lee Jones and No Country for Old Men, they are outmatched. they are in a world that has moved beyond them. And the aesthetics of the decade, you know, they try to traffic in them and they get run right the fuck over. And at first, when I first saw this, I'm like, oh boy, even though man's career really only started in the very, very early 80s, nascently in the super late 70s, the 80s really hit our boy hard with this one. But I was wrong. I was totally wrong. You know, once you watch this a time or two, you really key into it. And to use that word again, you realize he's arming you with a visual cinegrammer to understand the film, because it is a movie that, much like the works of my beloved BB, Brian De Palma, it is a film that we see, and it is a film that it is about the act of seeing.
Yes.
And to that, and by that I mean it is a film about a serial killer, Francis Dolarhyde, struggling to make the world see him as he wants himself to be seen. Like the sequence that we're gonna watch today, there's a song that plays through in real time that literally begins with the lyrics, "Look into my eyes, see me as I am," right? Yes. This is a film that begins with a woman being seen, and seeing something back. It's a movie that begins with Jack Crawford trying to get former agent Will Graham to see the family photos of the Leeds and the Jacobies. It is a film about Graham needing to see his almost killer, Lecter, once again to pick up a scent. It's a film about a woman who ironically cannot see at all, literally cannot physically see, and that this creates such a unique position for her character to be a potential catalyst for change or chaos. And it's a movie about one desperately unstable man who spends the entire film attempting to force himself to see the fantasies of a killer in order to catch him. And perhaps most importantly of all, it is a movie about us seeing the world in only the way that Dolarhyde, Lecter, and eventually in the scene right before this one, yes, Graham is finally able to see it. And I told you I was going to get you somewhere, gang. I know I'm insufferable, but I got you here. And where here is a place where I can say that Manhunter is a film of extremely, extremely, to the point of almost ludicrousness, but in a way that in the moment works and it really carries you, but is a film of extremely operatic and baroque psychological and mental states of total extremity, but they're all very deeply internal rather than external. They don't become externalized until they're acted upon, like Francis Dolarhyde fucking killing people or Graham's little monologues, which aside from the one that's coming up, I really don't like. I got to be honest with you. I'm sorry, William Peterson. That's a whole other conversation. But they rub me a little raw. They rub me a little raw. But these two men, they both share this really complicated labyrinthine psychology. And that can be hard, I think, to portray without the benefit of voiceover monologues and things like that, narration, which who wants that? So man externalizes with cinematographer Dante Spinotti, he externalizes their extreme inner states of being, their heightened states of awareness, into visual states of extreme spaces. And these men become objects in space as such. And so the reason that so much of this film, it looks the way that it is, it's designed the way that it is, it's about the collision of one person's mental state into another. And again, to use those words again, the kind of baroque operatic imagery that like nuclear fission of those collisions creates. And it's all very pretentious, I know, but Jesus Christ, have you seen the movie? It's pretentious. but I say all that because I think it's very important, because what we are going to see later in this sequence is, the reason that's important is that this whole movie is about Graham doing his goddamnedest to make himself once again be able to see the way men like Dolarhyde, the way men like Lecter see. And in the scene right before this one, he finally teaches himself to see Dolarhyde's fantasies. And then the scene right after this, which I'm so fucking jealous that, Jordan Harper got that scene. this is my favorite scene in the movie.
Sequence of guests that have been on this show from like scene 16 to scene 22. I won't spoil for people who listen to the next episode, but it's been Jan Johans, our dear friend, the Diana and a Blank boys, Priscilla Page, Roxana Haddadi, Brendan Hodges, Travis Woods, and Jordan Harper. I mean, if I don't think of that as like the Hall of Fame of the people that I could have gotten for these episodes, I would be crazy. But it's a very, very, very fun sequence of people that are leading up to you two. And of course, Jordan Harper and Travis Woods, just like Blake Howard and Travis Woods are right next to each other.
And, you know, look, beggars can't be choosers. I'm very happy to have this scene. I love this scene. I do love the next scene a little more. But you know what? In this case, sorry to use bad words. Jordan, he gets to fuck the prom queen this time. And that's cool. That's cool. I'm not jealous. I'm happy with the prime movers. This is cool stuff. I'm happy with it.
We love you. You're near it. You're in close proximity to this, you know.
But what I love about this moment, and the reason why I did kind of, when I was like, well, this is the one that I want to do, this is the moment, is, you know, the scene immediately preceding this is Graham finally keying in and seeing what Dolarhyde's fantasies are, right? You know, the perfect mirror of their eyes. And he's joined the club, to use a phrase that Mann has used. He's joined the club with Dolarhyde and Lecter, and he has slipped into the realm of their vision and the way that they see. He has the key to Dolarhyde's process, the way he sees a woman, and to use Graham's unique phrasing, the bloom he places on specific women. And so once... What's so fucking great about Mann, and even shows a level of maturity that I think is what separates him from a lot of other filmmakers, is that even at this point in his career, okay, Graham has taught himself to see as Dolarhyde does. Now, another movie, what would happen next? We'd see Dolarhyde perform a killing, and we'd see it the way he sees it, because okay, now we see like Dolarhyde, okay, we transition to our scene today, and because Graham can now see as Dolarhyde sees, Mann allows us for the first time really in the film to truly see the world through Dolarhyde's fractured vision, his vision of arrested development. And we don't see it as, I mean, there is a killing, but we don't see it as, okay, he performs a raid on the next house. We actually see the most humanizing fucking possible thing we could see. And we realize once again, like a lot of Thomas Harris's killers from his novels, this is a broken man child who has been stuck at 8 years old of development and just happens to have grown into the body of a monster. And we see this extraordinary, radically, radically humanizing moment of sadness. It doesn't take away Dolarhyde's responsibility for the actions that he performs here, but we understand them. And there's a sadness and a melancholy to them.
Because
our heart bleeds for him. Bleeds for him, like Graham's.
We can all relate. I think it's such a perfect choice, too, because we can all relate to fleeting moments of jealousy and sure, seeing the contrast. And he does these, like, he slips in this like little like refreshments of reality into the actual thing. So you kind There's of the offset,
the
right?
juxtaposition,
you see the juxtaposition, the gap between what is the reality, what is the truth of the actual undertaking.
It was just pollen. You know,
it's just, and that. And so when you see that together, you're like, oh, his whole fucking world is crazy.
Like, hey, Hey man, not to get weird, but when I found out you gave Jordan the next episode, the one that I really like, I got jealous and I had this visual of you and him framed in magenta light in the recording studio, and your
Oh,
hand
God.
caressing his cheek. And it turns out he just had an eyelash and you were letting him take it, you were taking it off and letting him blow on your fingers and make a wish. But in my mind, I saw something far more nefarious,
Saw
far
something
more
far,
upsetting.
far more malevolent,
Yeah. We all get jealous. We all have our little jealous
and then I
moments.
got tossed into a hedge. I was just
Yeah.
discarded into a hedge. If you next time you see me, oh
I did.
God.
And I just kept knocking on Jordan's door saying, "It's me. It's me. Travis isn't here anymore." Boy, this took a turn.
I like where it's going. This is my favorite part of what you said so
Jesus.
far.
This is turning into some fan fictions for some of our followers here. But yeah, I find this such a fascinating film in man's filmography because of the premium that is placed on the act of seeing in a very kind of, and I hate this word gets so overused, I know, sorry everybody, but in a very kind of meta way. And perhaps it's just because I literally have spent the last year and a half in the trenches of, well, not trenches, they're wonderful, but it's a wonderful place to be, but really in the trenches with the cinema of Brian De Palma for a very long project. And so I'm constantly focusing on filmmakers who really put a premium on the act of seeing. And that is what something that I think that Mann does here in a way he doesn't really do in any of his other films. Subtext is made text literally in that the following scene, the one that my beloved Jordan, who I'm quite jealous of, it gets, where there's that one of the moments where I do like where Graham does his weird little monologue thing. He's like, and you knew you needed a bolt cutter and every other goddamn thing because everything with you is seeing, isn't it? Your primary sensory intake that makes your dream live is seeing reflections, mirrors, images. You've seen these films, haven't you, my man? That is both Graham speaking to man, and that is man speaking to us about how to watch the movie. And I say all of that, and I get all that level of pretentious with you because A, I'm pretentious, but B, because that so serves as both a launching pad thematically for the film as a whole and today's scene in specific. It is about the act of seeing, and it is about the empathy and the level to leap beyond logic that is required to see as other people see.
Yes.
And that is what that is Graham's gift, and that is a gift, grift, excuse me. That is a gift that we should all have, wish we could, and it would serve us, and I think the world would be a lot nicer place. But that is Graham's gift, and it is a gift that he then gives to the audience so that we can see this next scene. This next scene can't work unless we see it as Dolarhyde sees it. If we saw this film purely objectively with those little objective cutaways, oh, just a pollen. If we saw this film purely objectively, or excuse me, the sequence, the movie doesn't make any fucking
No,
sense,
it
or at least
doesn't.
the scene doesn't. It's like, wait, I thought they were getting along. Why is Dolarhyde sitting outside her house and he's making these weird, sappy little faces? And then he shoots poor Ralph, who, what the hell? He's not even an asshole in this version of the movie like he is in the one that we won't say the name of. And it's like, what just happened? What just happened here? What did the And again, that's one of those things where so much of this movie is about internal states. It's about internal states that if you have the only way you can really convey them is either via narration, which would be so ham-fisted and lead-footed, or you give us, because hey, not to blow anyone's hair back, film is a visual medium, you give this information to us purely visually, impressionistically. Or what it was, as I said earlier, neon expressionism. You give it to us like that. And so much of this scene to me is a late in the game code key. It's like the key to the map of Manhunter. And it really articulates the cinegrammer that he uses, man, to tell this story. And I just, man, it's great. It's just, it's so artful and subtle.
It's the rewatchable, it's the trigger for rewatchability and like the cipher. It's like, oh shit, now
Cipher, yeah,
I'm gonna
exactly.
go
It's the
back and
cipher.
I'm gonna get that cipher for the rest of the movie. It's brilliant talking to you. God, your mind is beautiful. Okay.
Oh, honey bunny. How
We're
sweet of you
gonna
to say. Check is in the mail.
we're gonna get into this scene because I want you to interrupt it. I want us to talk through it. It's the tw it's I don't even know what episode this is going to be because we've done a couple of multiples in there, but this is scene 21 as I mapped it. On the theatrical cut, it is 1 hour, 29 minutes, 29 seconds to 1 hour, 32 minutes and 15 seconds a minute. The theatrical cut ends at about an hour 50, hour 55-ish back at the beach at the Graham home. I might quickly, before I hit start, Travis has seen the religious experience that is Michael Mann's 70 millimeter print of the director's cut, which is slightly diverges from the theatrical scene in that Graham visits the family.
Actually, I gotta say one thing. That's coming out. He's releasing that. That's another one that's getting a release. I mean, I think you've mentioned that, but I need the world to brace itself.
I don't know who's doing it. Who's doing it?
Studio Canal. Studio Canal is doing a 4K remaster. Ooh. Well, that's what Mann said. Your buddy, your pal, your bestie, at a 70 millimeter screening of Manhunter held by the American Cinematheque at a Beyond Fest 2 years back, I believe, at the Arrow Theater. He mentioned offhand that Studio Canal has the rights and they are in the process of a 4K restoration. And because I believe it's being overseen by our good pal Michael Mann, it's probably going to take a hot second because there is going to be a degree of rigor involved that the post-production team at Studio Canal is probably unfamiliar with.
That's a very fair thing to say. Unfamiliar is good because, yeah, he doesn't muck around.
Rigor. That's a good word. There's going to be a level of rigor involved. So it'll be probably a minute before that one gets announced. But he did say that it's going to be via Studio Canal, who does a lot of really good work.
Fantastic. Do a lot of the classics remastered if you have a look, and they do really good work. Highlander was theirs recently.
It
was
that's right.
Really blew me away. All right, let's get into this with my dear friend Travis Woods, this great scene. Let's listen to some Strong As I Am.
Oh, even that little, oh, I apologize for that noise, but oh God, I mean, what a perfect choice for a song. The Strong As I Am by the Canadian band Prime Movers. It's announcing, I use that word coronation earlier for your lovely hyperbolic intro of me, that even that little noise, it's like announcing, hey, we're doing a fucking set piece. Strap in. You know that movie I made last time called The Keep? Didn't make a lot of sense. I didn't really quite know what I was doing or saying, so I just heaped every bit of visual style in my playbook at it. Well, guess what? Now I know how to tell a story. He knew how to tell a story. We've seen Thief. But that it with the Keep, he didn't quite, I think, have a grasp on what story he was trying to tell. This movie, he knows what he's trying to say. This movie, he knows what story he's trying to tell. It's a story about seeing, and he is saying, strap in. I am taking everything I learned on the Keep, everything that I was armed with on the Keep, and now I am attaching it to a statement, to a film about something.
And three years of Miami Vice. Yeah, that can't go undersold about how important that like economy of storytelling and how that show, particularly in the first two seasons, is so fire for that. He's ready. It's only been a couple of seconds. He's so ready right now. He's like, here we go.
Your poor listeners, 5 hours later, we're going to get to that little bit of pollen on Reba's face.
Oh God. All right, here we go. Was sort of scanning across to Francis sitting in his car. And I love this weird boomerang thing that he has on the top roof. It reminds me of Crocodile Dundee for Australian fans of Australia's one of the most, broad films ever.
Well, what I like about that is it creates that shadowing across the top of his face so that even though he's not wearing his pantyhose mask, the line...
It's a very, we're paused at like exactly 90 minutes into this movie. This weird stark line.
The shadow makes a line right across the bridge of his nose, under his eyes. So if we recall, the first time we meet him, you know, we don't meet him until 1 hour deep into this bad boy. Mm-hmm. And when we do first see him, here I am. He's wearing pantyhose over the top of his face to, you know, both obscure who he is on the off chance Lounge somehow survives their encounter, but also it just looks cool and spooky. And that's kind of the face of the dragon is that version of him. And I don't know if it was intentional or just one of those moments, one of those great moments you hear about of cinematic happenstance where you're in the editing room and you're like, holy shit, look how the shadow falls upon his face. He is the red. Even though he's not wearing his mask, the mask of the red dragon is still there. It's still burned upon his flesh as a shadow. And you know, we get all pretentious and Jungian about shadows if we want, but then we'll be here for 10 hours instead of five. But yeah, I've always loved in this moment where even though he's like happy, he's happy Francis, he's excited to see Reba, which is kind of heartbreaking too, the way he smiles when he sees her. Yeah. The shadow of the dragon still lays across his face and from also, that first scene.
In the bottom half too, you've got the shadow and the cast of that mask is still on his face, but I've sort of like joked around a few times about Francis Dolarhyde's drip in this movie and his great clothes choices. Fantastic shirts, clothes. But here, he's a new wave guy.
He is. I mean, the dude's listening to Prime Movers in his van. Like, I mean, he's hip.
Yeah, he's hip.
He's kind of cool.
He's really cool. He's wearing a black. Not that cool drip. Yeah, cool taste in music, other stuff. By and large, not so cool, but. He's wearing a black shirt that has almost like electrical current blue zaps that are sort of cascading down. And I think another great wardrobe choice is that like he's got this cast of the Mask of the Dragon and his energy like is like it's even reflected in his wardrobe. He's like he's live right now, which is he's even more dangerous. You know, it's like
electric
zapping.
Electric currents are coursing literally across the surface of his skin via his clothing that he's wearing here. Yeah, the man's got drip. He's hip. He's cool. Was that Kids in the Hall sketch? He's hip. He's cool. He's 45.
Oh, my God. He's hip. Mm. He's cool. He's 45. That's
Kids There's a pull the none of you seen coming, huh? And yeah, like he's a puppy dog. The way he smiles, he sees Reba rolling up with Ralph from work. It's far less annoying in this film than as scripted in the film whose name we will not mention.
We can totally mention it. Red Dragon is a bag of shit. It has all of the best actors you could ever love in your life. It is written by Ted Talley. It is lens by Dante Spinotti, and it's still ghastly.
Whoa!
And
the problem.
Ralph is driving is that a Corvette? Am I wrong?
It's a Corvette.
Yeah,
it's a Corvette.
The Vet. The only thing I can keep thinking of forever, thank you, cinema, is The Vet Gets Him Wet. Which is Paxton's line from True Lies. I'm just like, oh God,
he drives up there
in a Corvette. I'm like, oh, Ralph.
I could be wrong. It's either, I think it's an 83, 84 Corvette driven by Ralph, played by Bill Swakowski, who deep man heads, real obsessive man heads, and those are the people listening to this show will know. He briefly went on to a cameo role in the Miami Vice first season episode No Exit. He's an unnamed gun dealer who gets braced by Crockett and Tubbs. I haven't seen him in much else, but I have seen him in these two man projects. But Red Dragon, a film that sucks because primarily two reasons. And boy, we're going to go afield here. I'm so sorry, everybody. So sorry. It's directed by a big old tub of monkey shit by the name of Brett Ratner, who couldn't film his way out of a wet paper bag. He's a fucking traffic cop. He's not a director. He's a traffic cop. He just points his camera and supervises movement. That is not filmmaking. Fuck him. And sorry everybody. I got hot. I haven't had enough caffeine yet this morning. I'm coming in hot.
I love this.
But also the other problem, and I hate to do this. Stopping this scene cold, but anyone who's had a conversation with me, those few unfortunate damned souls that have, they know this is what I do. The reason, I'll tell you, The reason why, I'll tell you the reason why Red Dragon doesn't really work as a film. You want to know why it doesn't really work as a film? Because it's an almost totally direct adaptation of the book. And I don't want to upset anybody. I don't want to ruffle any feathers. I don't want to break up the meat in here or nothing. I don't like Thomas Harris's books. I don't think they're very good. I think that somehow he took, no offense to these kind of writers, these kind of books. I think they have their place and they're fine. He kind of took airport fiction and somehow convinced everyone that he was making really artful thrillers. And it's like, no, these are airport paperbacks, and that's fine. Yeah, it's that's
like
fine.
Very fun in their lane. Very fun in their lane. Rich in a sense, but.
But they are so self-serious, and they are so, oh, Jesus, God. I think one of the reasons why so much good art elsewhere, not Red Dragon itself, but so much good art can come of Thomas Harris's works is, speaking of Jordan Harper, a conversation he and I have had often is about how often lesser material like pulp novels can actually make really great films, and yes, really great novels can actually make really bad films because the translation becomes so precarious. And I think one of the things that makes Thomas Harris's the essential, he's, you know what he is? He's great at a premise. He's great at a premise. I find him bad at execution. You know, he's a lot to me, speaking of the kids in the hall, and boy, I am just making, I'm taking his places. I'm so sorry with all these weird pulls. There's a kids in the hall sketch called Premise Beach, where it's a bunch of teenagers dancing on a beach, like a 1950s beach blanket bingo type of movie. But instead of like singing songs, they just hurl premises at each other. And they talk about, in one moment, they talk about what if human beings had gift boxes, wrapped gift boxes for a head, and they're all hiding out on Christmas, like it's the Holocaust. And they say, get it? Christmas is hell. If you have a gift for a head, it's a premise. And that is kind of what I think Thomas Harris does. Poor Blake. Thomas Harris does with his, he'll come up with a crackerjack premise. It's like, what if there's a serial killer? And what if there's a really combustible agent on their tail? And what if that serial killer or that combustible agent has to get help from another serial killer to get the first serial killer? That's a great premise. It's probably why he ripped himself off and did it twice in Red Hunt, Red Dragon. And then again in, Silence of the Lambs. And the reason that these premises work is because they are so, I think one of the reasons pulp fiction, the genre, not the film, pulp fiction works is it takes very elemental subject matter. Like in the case of Silence of the Lambs, a princess has been kidnapped by a monster in the woods, and an untested warrior has to go save the princess and take advice from the warlock living under the bridge. And that's very basic, very Joseph Campbellian storytelling structure that we seek out as human beings. Anyway, I am so sorry for everyone for taking us on that little conversational cul-de-sac, but I just had to work in at some point. That is A, why I think so many of the movies based on Thomas Harris's books, so much of the art that is based on his work is compelling, is because they all kind of traffic in that elemental stuff. This film does it. Silence of the Lambs does it. The Hannibal TV show.
Great series.
Does it.
Great series.
Hey, you know what? It's not high art. I like the Ridley Scott movie.
I do too, because he's,
you know,
doing
it's fun.
He's
it's pulp. It's pulp.
Maker.
He's making a pulp. And
he's making
the thing
a
about
universal horror movie with fucking
sure,
Anthony Hopkins.
That's exactly
that's
it. To use those words I used earlier, Baroque and operatic. Ridley, yes. I mean that is Ridley Scott, and yeah, he gets it. He has no bone. He has no bones about making pulp. Ridley, but it's also I think one of the reasons why fucking Red Dragon sucks, and it does.
I'm gonna pause your spiel here and just say, I love you, because so many times I feel like people, when I get vitriolic about Red Dragon, fucking sucks, right? And so many people have just like sort of laugh at my nonsense. But I'm so happy that you're here, because Travis just does it
I'm getting
in
angry.
Such a Travis way that just
I'm getting hot.
You know what? This is why I love this guy. I love him so much. We're just in so many ways we're different, but in some ways at these core tenets, we just align, and it's just like, I'm gonna love this guy for the rest of my life. He's
I mean, I believe
good.
I'm now on record for calling Brett Ratner a tub of monkey shit. Which he is, for myriad of reasons. But the reason Red Dragon, thank you, Blake. I appreciate you saying that. I miss you, buddy.
Miss you too,
The
pal.
reason Red Dragon sucks, and it does, the reason it's fucking trash, despite having one of the most auspicious casts of the 21st century, and returning Manhunter alum Dante Spinotti, is
Exactly.
the reason it sucks is because, like Thomas Harris, you get the sense that fucking Ratner is treating the material like it's high art. And that's the problem. That's the problem. Jonathan Demme makes high art because he's an artist. So he turns, and there's nothing wrong with pulp. I don't say this to be derogatory towards pulp, but he takes the pulp of the Silence of the Lambs novel and he makes it high art because he's an artist. Same with Michael Mann here. He takes a pulp of Red Dragon and he makes a kind of art, a pop art, but still art with Manhunter. The reason Red Dragon fucking sucks is because Brett Ratner thinks he's an artist and not a tub of monkey shit, so he's wrong on that count. And then
On both counts, Ratner.
he
Wrong on
makes the
both
mis
counts.
he makes the mistake of approaching Red Dragon like he's adapting art. He is not adapting art. Pulp can be art, but Red Dragon the book, it's a fun pulp exercise. I mean, for Christ's sake, there is a character named Hannibal the Cannibal. If I wrote a book about a killer named Lurderer the Murderer, you can bet that, the editor would be like, you know what? Do you need that? I
It's
don't know
on the
if we need
nose. It's on
that.
the nose,
Like,
Trav. You don't need
it's a
it.
little on the nose. And the fact that that Harris literally named his character Hannibal just because of that one run. Come on. Anyway, I'm going off track. The point is, Red Dragon sucks because Brett Ratner saw himself as the inheritor of Michael Mann and the inheritor of Jonathan Demme, which Jesus, goddamn jug
Gross.
fucking Christ.
Gross.
He is the furthest thing from either of those men
And really,
in
he
every
backs
possible
up.
way.
He backs up Michael Mann, Jonathan Demme. I mean, can't say enough about Jonathan Demme. That is, can't heap enough effusive hyperbole on Jonathan Demme's artistry. Then Ridley, and he's like, "Oh, I'm the next guy.
I'm in that pantheon.
I'm in
I'm
that
in
pair.
that group.
I'm
I'm
on
in
that
that group.
Mount Rushmore." It's like, are
I
you?
made Rush Hour.
It's like, get out of here. All right, well, from so many kids in the
Sorry,
hall
everybody.
sketches, from so many kids in the hall sketches in Canada, back to the Canadian group, the Prime Movers. Let's keep going. Th one hour
Oh, well,
30.
this is why Blake's a host. This is why Blake is a host. Oh, boy. Look at that.
90
Okay.
minutes, 17 seconds. Let's go. Ralph, I'm really sorry in advance.
And here we
Tough
have, like,
call.
this is one of those objective moments. This is that we're seeing things as they are.
Yes.
We're seeing things as they exist. Ralph and Reba, he's being a good guy, coworker, just leading her to her front door, making sure she gets home safe from the development lab. And very, very importantly, while we are seeing the film this moment, we're seeing the scene from the window of Dollar Hyde's car. We are not seeing it from his eyes, from that
Okay.
shadowed, shadow flit, shadow covered, shadow masked vantage of his eyes.
And what I love about this moment where we've just paused at 25 seconds, 90 minutes, 25 seconds, is that the hint of his perspective is already
The
coming
glow of those
through in
lights,
the glow of the
that
lights. It's like,
coral glow above her door.
yes, it's just like something is about to be unreal here, from this perspective, and it's great, and I love
This heat, the heat of his madness almost,
it.
to glowing above that door.
And back
And
into
yeah, we
his
see him
face.
the shadow, and the way he lowers his face, like he can't look. It's too painful. This man who has seen God knows what manner of horrors, both in his personal life and his childhood, and also what he has done to others, he can't, like, for a moment, he literally has to look down. And the first time I saw this, one of the reasons I did want to do this scene is even the first time I saw this, when I wasn't really feeling the film and I wasn't understanding it, I was not mature enough to grasp what man was doing visually. This scene did grab me, the humanity of it, the pathos of it, and the sadness of it. And I, like Graham, believe that this is a sick fuck who should be blown out of his socks. But also in this moment, my heart bleeds for Francis Dollar Hyde because he does not have the equipment to understand and articulate what he is saying. And so he just assumes the worst. And it's heartbreaking
Absolutely
for everyone
heartbreaking.
involved.
And his eyes go down. Still objective POV.
Yeah, the back
And
of the door.
then back, and this is where it gets into his gaze. 41, 42.
Let's just say one more time. We get that. We literally have a close up of his brain, of his head, the top of his head. It's like it's funny. It's like man is not being subtle here.
No.
Yeah, he gives us a close up. He puts his head down. We get a close up of his big bald cranium, and almost like the opening credit sequence of Fight Club. We are now going to be like ripped into the fear center of his brain, yes, and see what scares him the most.
And this is what scares him. And
right as the chorus kicks in too.
Right here. He's clenching his jaw, like you can see it undulating in his face, and he looks over.
Oh God. The look on his face of agony. Like he's been stabbed.
It's exactly 91 minutes, and it resembles, I know this is gonna sound, it's gonna sound exactly what man wanted out of this performance. So this is how affecting it is, but it's like this is like when something like what I might seem trivial, like, oh, you know, I might say to like Keaton Hazel that like, oh, we're not going to see your friends today. Like maybe we had a plan to go see some of their friends for a play date.
Sure.
And something will happen, you know, just as in life. Oh, no, they've got to go here. They've got to do something. We can't make it happen today. And I literally watch like a little person like get so sad that he's not going to be with his friends that he just doesn't know what to do. He's not equipped with the emotional intelligence. Like, oh, like, yeah, you got to understand parents. He just, it's such a childlike lack of control of emotion in this very second as it's frozen here, that whatever's going to happen next is also informed by like someone who is completely emotionally stunted. I think you said Arrested Development a couple of times there, which is so perfect, like succinct, but I just love this. Now the offset, now we're going to hit play. We're going to be in his POV. I mean,
yeah, Reba and Ralph, they're hazed in this choral backlight that is kind of exploding out of the window of her front door, but you can also see the reflection of it on the wall behind him. So they're also being front lit as well. Spinotti does something really amazing here. I would love just to see a whole like bonus feature. If your best friend Mr. Man is listening, I'd love to see a bonus feature just on the filming of this sequence.
It's almost like X-ray vision or something.
You know what it reminds me of? You know, I've been writing about Basic Instinct recently, so I've been doing some research and going through like a lot of those old paperback thrillers, paper sex thrillers of like the late 80s, early 90s, where they have a front cover and then you pull the cover open and there's like a second glossy cover page. Yes. There'll be like holes in the front cover of the book that kind of peek at this. And, it's usually something that looks exactly like this, you know, a man and a woman haloed in magenta or coral light. They're touching each other. There's almost something kind of Raphaelite about their physicality and the way their mouths are gaping open, hungry.
The bone structure too. She's got this amazing, like,
yeah.
She's got this amazing they're haloed. Bone structure and haloed. Yeah.
And what I love about it is, to me, what I always think of when I see this, I think of pulp sex thriller covers. And what is Red Dragon, as I rather inarticulately raged earlier, they are pulp sex fillers. And there's something about this sequence, probably not intentional, it's probably me just bringing my own weird obsessions to bear here, but the way that man takes that and makes, in this moment, we are finally, after 90 minutes of talking about it, and what feels like, I'm sure, 390 minutes of talking about it on this show, in this episode, we are now finally in Dollar Hyde's mind. We have slipped into the course of his vision, and his vision to me is that of pulp sex thrillers, which is both tragic and disturbing and wholly appropriate. And the fact that he sees the world as it would be presented on the cover of a pulp sex thriller makes so much sense to me.
Yeah.
The sadness that he would take that and make it something so heightened and monumental to create murder with. But at the end of the day, it is just something that is so kind of sad and empty calorie and hollow and yet beautiful. That is the film. That is the dark black beating neon heart of the film is this sequence and the way man frames it.
So beautiful. It's just agonizing. I love the eyes back to him.
And he looks so sad here. Part of the reason he's sad, Francis Dolarhyde dies in this moment.
Yeah.
Before he even kills Ralph, Francis Dolarhyde, we were watching him slip away.
Yeah.
This that sad look
he's
in his
not
face.
Gonna and need, I think, he's not going to need that. He's something that we'll probably pronounce more heavily when we get to the exact moment. But it's like he doesn't need any masks anymore.
No, and when he comes to the door, and she's like, "Who is it? Francis?" He doesn't respond to Francis. He just keeps saying, "It's me. It's me." And that very weird, kind of incel-y, creepy, dude. But appropriately so. And the fact that later in the film, he will literally see the face of Francis in a mirror, and that'll be the first thing that he punches and that he shatters because he can't look at that anymore. But we are watching the kind of the child that Francis Dolarhyde is in many ways, that has been kind of the dragon has been trying to murder throughout the film. The ultimate kill for the dragon is to kill the child that is Francis Dolarhyde. At least that's how I read the book. And in this scene, we are seeing that conveyed wholly visually. We are watching the life of Francis, the boy, drain out of the dragon's face. And hey, Tom, let me just say, the performance that Tom Noonan gives in this sequence alone, wholly wordless up until, it's me. But this van sequence, utilizing the surging choruses of the Prime Movers, and this is a great fucking song, by the way, using that and using the greatest tool, cliche to say, but the greatest tool any actor has is their face, and just using his face to convey to us all of these very pretentious things that you and I are bouncing back and forth. He is saying all of those same things. And the reason he's an actor and we're not, he is saying all of those things with the way he hoods his eyes with his eyelids, the way he pouts his bottom lip. He's conveying all of that with one plaintive stare at this thing that is actually not happening. That's fuck it. That's amazing. It's sorry to say fuck everybody so much, everybody, but hey, this is an R-rated movie, so it's okay. See the dragon, the wingspan of the dragon, and Tom Noonan's gargantuan fucking hand.
He could catch a fucking basketball and an NFL ball in his hand at once. He's gigantic. It's amazing.
I was watching a video on Twitter of a attractive young lady crushing a watermelon between her thighs. I was watching it for reasons that we won't get into here. I was curious. And she did it. Bless her heart. She did it.
Gonna need a moment or two alone, boys.
My DMs are open if she's listening. I can imagine him one-handed just taking a watermelon and just squeezing it like until it pops. Like, he's fucking humongous. And even his hand, the film doesn't do a lot with the concept of the dragon, which I think is fine. Like, I'm not one of those. Like, there are some people, like, I didn't even remember that. I believe even that tub of monkey shit, Brett Ratner, complained about that and talked about how he was going to heighten that in his version of the film. You get it in these subtle ways, both the blood spatter that spreads out from his body, Dolarhyde at the end of the film, but also in this, even his hand, it's like a claw, yes, or like a wingspan stretching across the vinyl of the front of his van as it rips it off. There's something so talon-like and dragon-like about that, that I, it's just, again, it's, A+, no notes, just a perfect sequence.
Just a perfect use of someone's physicality in a scene to tell a story.
And we can keep it playing as I say this. I just think that so much of this scene is an inheritor to all the things that the Keep couldn't really accomplish, and this accomplishes in one like 2-minute sequence. Like, he takes all the music video stylings, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, so I'm just going to heap a lot of visual tricks onto this, and hopefully it'll just carry the audience through and they will have some sort of subconscious understanding. Here it works in a way that the Keep doesn't. I don't mean to slag the Keep. I bought it too. I'm very excited to see it in 4K. But what the Keep could not do in 2 hours, Manhunter does in 2 minutes in this sequence. Most ably, across more than any other sequence in the film. We were talking off mic that an interesting idea would be to watch the Keep as a silent film with just like a Tangerine Dream live rescore.
Yes.
This, I don't think Manhunter could do that. This scene in Manhunter could do that. Almost does it, basically. You take out this little line about, oh, it's just pollen in your face, and it's me. you know, you could take out even the "it's me," just the look on Noonan's face when she opens the door. We know that Francis is dead and the dragon remains. And this is just a 2-minute music video that conveys the entirety of the film's thematic underpinnings with just faces and light and misconception and trickery. And I know that Mann was very influenced by early Russian filmmaking of the 20s and 30s, the style of montage that he employs so overwhelmingly effectively here. This is everything The Keep couldn't do in 2 hours, and we get it in like a 2-minute capsule Miami Vice styled music video, and I applaud it. It's amazing.
It's wonderful. And it's also, there's a fantastic edit after you see him tear the vinyl from the front of the car. He tears the vinyl back, and immediately in that cut, we sort of detach from his POV just for a second. And what's so cool is Ralph shrinks. So they've had Ralph up on like a box. So he's even taller in Francis' conception. And it's so apparent that he comes back. He's just a short guy. He's like, oh, you've just got
he's
some
a little
pollen.
Guy.
Just a little guy is fine. He's lit by the street lights. Street lights are ugly, down lights, harsh, no warmth in them whatsoever. And you get that, and it's completely contrasted from this glorious thing. And he seems like a shorter guy, doesn't have like a strong chin. But when in that lighting, all the lighting makes him just look so.
He's Fabio.
Yeah, he exactly.
He's Fabio on a cover of one of those Harlequin romances. In real life, you know, he's just a nice short king, Ralph. He's just
bless
doing a good deed.
Bless your heart.
Just trying to take this. He's not even trying to like do what Frank Wally does in Red Dragon, like, you know, seduce or anything. He's literally just like, hey, I'm just going to give you a ride.
Yeah.
You need anything? All right.
Sweet guy. Thanks. Thanks.
See you tomorrow. See you at work.
See you at work.
Pollen.
Bro. Thanks for the ride.
See you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now he's walking back to his car. And just love this frame. 56... 91 minutes, 56 seconds, because when he looks up and he's scared, he's barely up to Francis's shoulder, his entire
height.
Yeah,
I mean, the casting of Tom Noonan is another reason this works so, so well, is that Tom Noonan is, some people also probably know him as, I grew up with him as the fucking Frankenstein's monster from the Monster Squad, cinema classic. But he's like, what, 6'3", 6'4", 6'5"? I mean, he's humongous, and so well cast in this film. And yeah, the way, like, the frame, Dante Spinotti's frame here in this moment, you pause it, cannot contain. We only get his shoulder. That's literally all that fits. Mm-hmm. We get the entirety of Ralph's face and what would be his shoulders and chest and torso, hidden by foliage. We get maybe part of Francis's shoulder. That's how huge Noonan is.
Yeah, he's massive. And then he gets the shock. Oh.
Mr. Dalhide, what are you doing here?
He just walks through the damn hedge, clutches
I
him
hate to
by
say
the throat, and then he just shoots him unceremoniously and leaves him there. Pew, pew, pew. And then he just starts walking. And he's nearly as tall as the doorframe, not even near the steps.
He's so fucking huge. And I hate to say it, you're right. You know, he's a despicable killer. You're right, though. He just looks cool, man. This is a cool-ass outfit. He's basically dressed like Jeff Daniels at the end of Something Wild, which is just cool-ass new wave dude who's been through the shit, and he's come out the other side, and he's cool now. He's literally just – I believe same costume designer for both films, actually, Something Wild and Manhunter. Really? I believe it's the same. Wow. I'm gonna forget her name because I'm a monster. Carolyn something, I believe. Colleen Atwood. Yeah. And I believe I could be totally wrong again. I do believe she did Something Wild. And
a legendary costume designer across like many, 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 many films. And you are. Wait, let's have a look. She
did I make a fool of myself, Blake? Did I make that up?
She was a costume designer on, wait, I'm going to go to costume department as well just to make sure. She was actually a costume designer on Manhunter. She's Married to the Mob. She was on that as well.
There we go. Close enough. Close enough.
But Edward Scissorhands, Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, Ed Wood, like Jesus Christ,
All
Fallen.
of which, are films too, in which, I mean, this should happen all the time, but sometimes people just wear a t-shirt. All of which are films in which, much as Dante Spinotti does with the visuals and the production team does with the locations, she is an artist who conveys emotional states through the clothing.
Yes.
And she really does that here, especially between Graham and his unique method of dress once he gets out of his little purple booty shorts, and the way
Which
that
you
she
know better than anyone, I bought a pair of those
you
shorts so
did
that I could
you
wear them for you
you
and Katie.
couldn't get your pants off fast enough and into those shorts when we picked you up from LAX. I believe it was within 15 minutes. Those shorts were on you. The way that she conveys, and in a weird way, it's almost like you get that sense of hopefulness in the way Francis dresses, in that he's kind of, again, murdering aside, he's kind of an interesting guy, a cool guy. Like, he's the guy that re he could be the guy that Reba imagines him to
Look at
be.
the
Like, there's
decor in his
potential here.
house. The
There's
decor in his house
potential
is
here.
amazing, yeah.
Well, again, environments reflecting mental states. You know, he's this, weird aberrance of nature, and his entire home is nothing but gloomy, sickly lunar greens and bright magentas, much like some of the magenta light in this sequence when the door opens. And the reason for that is because Dante Spinotti believed that red and green don't fall together on the color spectrum in the universe naturally, that it's an aberration. And that's what Dolarhyde is. He's an aberration. And so he's always suffused with these greens and these purple reds. And so too is his home. And just here in a moment, the door is going to open, and we're going to see that Reba's entire home is that weird, sickly lunar green. It's been infected with the same green as his home and of the dark rooms they work in. And then that weird red coral magenta is going to blare in around him, and it's going to be that aberrance again, that environment reflecting the wrongness of him again. Just like the clothes reflect that he could have been a cool dude, could have been a cool guy.
As you said,
Yeah, there's that weird, like, dark room green.
darkroom green, all the lights off. It's such a practical thing, but it's also something that's so underdone in movies where blind characters have all their lights on
Why
in their home.
would she turn her lights on? Yeah, why
Because
would she bother? She doesn't need him to see.
she doesn't need him to see.
It's me.
Who? Who is it?
It's me.
Francis?
No.
Oh my God.
And the way he's
What?
standing, like, again, it's almost like a little boy trying to be cool. Like it's again, there's just he's a child wedded to a monster, and it's like that was the this is the child dying. And the way she says, Francis, no, and just that jaw jutting, poking his face up in the air like a little boy trying to be tough. It's
And
so
I just love
sad.
how her white dress is just like enveloped in the red. It's so, oh my
Yeah.
God. It's just so, this is how you make movies, folks. This is a great slide. This is a great little just like slide picture of this movie, a screenshot. It's just magnificent. He's just standing there and she's so, God, she's so
And the light
unassuming.
pouring in around him, it's like his sickness is just pouring in. And as Spinotti said, green and red don't fall together on the color spectrum naturally in the universe. And so, again, that thing I was talking about where man is conveying the extraordinarily heightened and extreme mental states of these characters via composition, the flooding, like a vomit, the flooding of this red light into this formerly pristine green. It's the infection of Dolarhyde flooding into this world and making it an aberration, making it wrong.
And it's also the closest visually similar moment of the actual Red Dragon painting. So we've seen his like talons clutching the car, and then now this is like, to the woman bathed in light. Like we can't see that she's bathed in light, but the light is coming through him. He's staring over her, and she's about to be consumed, right? Is the whole point. But it's just this beautiful moment that man does it in its much more grounded way for a movie that is already completely ungrounded.
And, it's, to go on one more flight of pretension, one more, that I'm going to do like 50 more, but one more flight of pretension, there's also the tragedy of it. Again, I don't feel sympathy per se for a character like Dollar Hyde, but, I do think of that line a lot. My heart bleeds for him. This was a, someone made this person a monster. There's a tragedy in the fact that, I spoke earlier about when you see Ralph and Reba at the door and they're framed in that coral light, they look like a Harlequin romance cover or like a sex thriller cover. He loved her, she loved him. Would anyone discover their secret? Kind of tagline cover. The closest that Dollar Hyde can ever be to being a figure in a cover like that is the threatening invader monster that we see
Yes.
here. The closest to the dream, this is a movie that is so much about dreams and fantasies. And right now we are kind of watching, this is another one of those subjective scenes where we're seeing things the way he imagines they look, right? With this light and everything, we're seeing things the way he imagines they look. How pathetic is it that even in his fantasy world now, the best he can do is be the monster. Like he can't even be the figure of, he can't even be the Fabio figure of romance, cradling the woman's face at her doorway in this red light. He can only now be the guy that on a book cover that looks like this would be the invader, would be the threat, because, and that's what he is. But how pathetic it is that even in his fantasy world now, best, that phrase people do, best I
He
can do is,
looks like a
whatever.
sci-fi, like Day the Earth
Best he
Stood
can do is
Still
be the
figure.
killer. Say
Yeah.
that again.
He looks like the Day the Earth Stood Still figure, right? It's like the 50s
Oh my
sci-fi
God.
pop.
Yeah. He's the Klaatu Bariku, that guy. But that big old bald pate of his and the fact that he's 8 feet tall. But yeah, that's exactly it. Even in his insanely, literally insanely, his insanely rich fantasy life, things have become so sour now, so sick, with that sickly magenta light. Best he can do is be the monster. That's the best he can do, like even in his own fantasy life, and that is tragic. And again, these are such weighty, existential, philosophical, radically humanist ideas, and they are all ideas that man is managing to convey with these extraordinary visuals. The ones that turned me off the first time I saw this movie, as I admitted 9 hours ago at the beginning of this podcast, but he's showing us why he had to make the movie this way. Because you can't just have narration go, and that's when I realized I could never have Reba. He's saying that without having to say it by
Doesn't need
giving
to say it.
visuals like this. And that is, oh God damn. This kid, man, he's got a future. He's got a future in the pictures,
He's
I
got a
think.
future in the
I
picture.
think. We'll see.
But Francis is gone. Francis is gone forever.
The
Favorite
whole.
favorite thing about that ending, and I just get this out of the way now so that you can have room to talk on your own goddamn show. One of It's a tiny, tiny little thing, and I don't know why I like it other than I find it harrowing. He doesn't hard cut the song off when it cuts. He doesn't wait to. He doesn't hold the song and let it keep playing and cut it right when we cut to Graham in the next scene. He lets the song die and lets the song continue, or lets the scene play for like 2 more seconds of just them looking at each other. And it's almost like he doesn't go so far and be so jarring as to take the weird lighting away or anything like that. But by letting the song stop playing and just having these two people here, it's so frightening because you go, oh wait, yeah. This isn't just a movie. This is happening. Like this isn't just a stylish music video, cool groove moment in Michael Mann's existential neon noir filmography. This is a woman who's going to be ripped to pieces by this monster because he got his little feelers hurt. And letting the song die, but letting the scene play out just for like 2 more seconds and then slapping you in the face by cutting to Graham's face. I don't know. It was one of those great, applaud editor Dove. Just one of those great moments where like so many lesser directors would have let the song play and then hard cut right when it cuts to Graham, and instead letting it die. There's something about that that's just, it lets the reality of this situation flood back into the vacuum that was previously occupied just by this madman's imagination.
And you realize the music is in his head. That's the other scary moment.
Yeah.
It's like, is 1 hour. So it's 92 minutes, 32 seconds here. So Francis is nurturing, if you like, this, you know, like a, what you think has got like chloroform or something on it. So when it plays, like, you don't even get to see him touch her. I'm just going to let it play.
Francis is gone.
And it comes in and the music's fading. And he just takes a step and he doesn't even let you see. Doesn't even let you see that he's going to chloroform her face.
Yeah.
He just steps so impossibly close to her and uncomfortably close to her that you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. And then now we're here.
And doing so, he steps out of the way he's framed in that light. He becomes pure shadow. He becomes pure silhouette in that moment. Francis is gone. As he says, Francis is literally gone. All that is left is, again, I'm not going to get all Jungian on the same podcast that I was talking about a lady popping watermelons with her thighs.
You have to.
But these are the ABCs of me, folks. This is what happens when you talk to me. It's going to be watermelon thighs and Jungian philosophy. But he does become pure shadow in that moment. And that's just, it's like one of those moments where it's like, I don't know if Spinotti planned it. I don't know if man planned it. If it just is like one of those things in the editing room that man has talked about where, you know, you don't make a movie when you're making a movie, you make a movie in the editing room. And if this is one of those moments where, my God, he becomes pure shadow in this moment, keep that moment, let the song play out, but keep that beat. And maybe the last bit of pretentiousness that I'm going to throw at us here is I do want to talk about that Prime Movers for a second,
and the inclusion,
you know, so much of the music in this film is, you know, diegetic. It's what we're listening to on the radio. And I want to believe that even though it's very music video-esque, you know, he's sitting in his car. Maybe that's the song that he's listening to is the Prime Movers, because he's a hip dude. He is hip. I get the sense Dollar Hyde probably does have a couple of Prime Movers LPs, you know, on the turntable at home. But it makes me think of how man, because he's man, because he's Michael Mann, he's fucking nuts. The level of research this guy does, you know this. Blake knows this more than a lot of people realize Blake knows this. But man spent several years corresponding with this imprisoned murderer, Dennis Wayne Wallace, for whom he took a lot of inspiration to craft his version of Dollar Hyde, his film version of Dollar Hyde. Wallace had been in prison because he had developed this obsession with a woman that he'd only met for like 45 minutes. And all of a sudden, look at that 45 minute meeting into high gear, into like a Taxi Driver Travis Bickle level of obsession, where he found out that this woman named Vicky, she lived in like a trailer park court where there was a biker gang, Peckerwood biker gang. We're getting to Jordan Harper territory here. There was a Peckerwood biker gang that was, they were cooking meth in the same trailer park that Vicky lived. And so what did this guy, Dennis Wayne Wallace, do? He goes and he murders the entire fucking biker gang just because he saw them as a threat to her. He saw this, their masculinity and their danger, as a threat to this woman named Vicky that he'd only met for 45 minutes, which is a total Dollar Hyde thing. The Dollar Hyde of this scene would do that in a heartbeat. Killed the dude because he got her pollen off her face. but the other thing about that was so influential upon this film is the fact that in that 45 minute meeting, that hour meeting that he had with this Vicky that created this entire fantasy world within Dennis Wayne Wallace, he decided that they had a song together, that they are like a couple's have a song. and he decided that their song was In a Gata Da Vida.
Yeah.
Which is why he chooses that for the climax. But in this moment, I'm like, oh, this is Francis Dollar Hyde deciding that Strong As I Am is the ballad of their relationship. It is their song. It is the song of their love's birth and its death. And this is one of those bits of layering that everyone likes Michael Mann for different reasons. You've spent so many hours explaining to us why you do, and letting others like myself explain why we do. One of the reasons I do is how Mann will lattice so many strange little nuggets of, to use this word again, aberrance and aberration that exist in our world. And he he lards those things on top of these stories. And you can go your whole life never knowing that thing I just told you,
of course,
and being able to enjoy the Inigata to beat a climax, able to enjoy the prime movers, able to enjoy this scene. But knowing that and knowing the level of rigor and research he had to take, spending years communicating with this killer before, just knowing someday that's going to come into play. I'm going to use that somewhere.
It's in the air. It's in the color palette.
What is Tom Noonan? Tom Noonan. What does Tom Noonan say in Heat? These things, they're just in the air. I just know how to grab them. They're in the air. You just have to grab them. I know how to grab them. That is exactly. Oh boy, look at us. We're cooking, Blake. We're cooking. That is what Tom Noonan does. That's what he says in Heat, and that's what Michael Mann does in real life. He is a man who lives with his antenna up. And he knows that these things, these transmissions, are in the air. He just knows how to grab them. To quote Graham in the scene that's coming up next, there is selection and design in his choices always. Mm-hmm. In the implementation of his fantasies, you know, Graham's talking about Dollar High. We're talking about, man, there is selection and design in his choices always. And even in something like, we're in the movie with Inigata DeVita, which the first time you watch it, you're like, what the fuck? What? This is like the least new wave song in a soundtrack full of new wave, like goth songs. What is this? Or even the fact to turn what we just saw into a music video. And you're like, oh, you realize it's a music video because this hip guy who watches a lot of TV, including probably MTV, this is the music video that he's crafting in his head, the way we'll do sometimes when we're hurt or we're dramatic and we're listening to a song, and we will turn it into a mini emotional adventure for ourselves. That's exactly what's happening here. Dennis Wayne Wallace did it when he murdered a fucking biker crew for this gal named Vicky. Poor Vicky. I hope you're okay. And he does the same thing here with Strong As I Am, a song that he's very clearly emotionally resonating with. And like I said, begins with that line, see me as I am. Mm. You know, it's, why does he take her to feel up a fucking tiger on their first date? He sees himself as a beast like that. He wants her to touch its fangs, touch its teeth, because what is his weapon of choice? It's his teeth. It's his fangs. He's wanting to be seen. And so he literally crafts this music video fantasia of his own. The death of his own innocence here. And again, these are just, man is just trafficking in ideas of such heightened, high scale emotional volatility and extremity. And he's just, that he's able to do it all visually is kind of stunning. And it's something, like you said, I don't think he does a lot of, or as with such a level of extreme until we start getting back into Miami Vice territory.
Yeah.
The film. And he starts going, oh, you know, we can get a little weird with shit. We can make these movies kind of reflect the interstates of the characters a little bit more than reality does. And I think that there's something just so kind of unique and brilliant about this film for doing that. Even if I disagree with certain other choices in it, I don't like those monologues. I don't like them. but other than that, yeah, it's wow. Like, wow. Look at us.
Look at us cooking. Oh man, I just want to sit here and I want to bask. You know, when you make a great meal and you're just sitting there and it's resting, you know, make a great steak and you just got to let it rest.
Sure.
We're going to let this steak rest. Let you guys just anticipate pouring over it again. Oh man, I love you. Thank you so much for
love
doing
you too,
this.
Buddy. Miss you.
Miss you unbelievably. Travis Woods. He's the best. We have had so much fun. I didn't know that we'd go to the woman, which I also saw, squashing a watermelon with her thighs, all the way to Jungian shadows.
You saw her too, huh? Hey, bless her heart. Bless her heart too.
Our algorithms sometimes mesh. And honeycomb.
Much like Dollar Hyde and Graham, eventually our algorithms of our fantasies intersect and we understand one another. And it's you know, with them, it's the mirror of the deceased eyes. For us, it's muscle mommy shattering
thighs. latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there. And the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year. But if you are a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Min Hunter episode, Min Hunter video podcast will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there. So you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods, or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.